deciphering the new blood pressure guidelines. Just a couple weeks ago, leading heart experts changed the guidelines regarding high blood pressure. The American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology recommended that anyone with a blood pressure reading higher than 130 over 80 be considered as having hypertension. Under these guidelines, nearly half of all Americans, 46%, will be identified as having high blood pressure, and as many as three-quarters of men between the ages of 55 and 74. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll learn more about why the decision was made to change the guidelines. What do they mean for those who are now considered hypertensive? Will more people need to be medicated? And why are some doctors skeptical of the new numbers? What are your questions about blood pressure? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Brand new blood pressure guidelines mean millions of people who did not have high blood pressure before now do. We'll find out what the guidelines, why the guidelines changed and what it means for your health. With me in the studio today, Dr. Craig Brett. He is Medical Director of Mercy Cardiology at Mercy Hospital. Dr. Peter Ammon is site leader for Maine Medical Partners, and he is with Scarborough Family Medicine. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you worried about what the new blood pressure recommendations mean for you? Have you made changes to your lifestyle? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Joining us now on the line is Dr. Doug Sawyer, Chief of Cardiovascular Services at Maine Medical Center. He is a spokesperson for the American Heart Association. The American Heart Association, one of the organizations providing the new guidelines. Dr. Sawyer, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Jennifer.
Why did the American Heart Association and other groups decide to change the blood pressure recommendations?
I think it's become clear over the recent past that blood pressure is a continuum, and there's elevated risk of the effects of high blood pressure beginning at a lower number than we used to use as a strict definition of hypertension.
This came out of a study, right?
Mm-hmm. And we've learned that the risk of a heart attack or stroke begins to go up even over a systolic blood pressure of 120 or diastolic blood pressure of 80, whereas we used to say high blood pressure is anything over 140 over 90. We now recognize that there's a continuum in between those numbers that is important for patients and people to understand and manage.
Since these guidelines came out, we've heard a lot of pushback, really. People are concerned that the lower numbers will lead to over-treating people who might not really need medication. What do you say to that?
Well, I'd say it's important that, A, people talk to their providers about this, and, B, recognize that there's things besides medications that help people control their blood pressure, and those are important for all of us. So I know that there are skeptics out there that think this might drive more use of hypertensive medications, but we all need to embrace the idea that everything we do every day has an effect on our blood pressure, stress level, exercise, diet, our body mass, our body weight.
Dr. Sawyer, it was really big news a couple weeks ago when these guidelines changed, but I remember just a few years ago they changed as well. How often are these reevaluated and adjusted?
Well, I think the American Heart Association, American Stroke Association, American College of Cardiology have ongoing evaluations that are updated when we recognize there's a clear shift in the data that's important for us to get out to providers and people. So there's not a strict plan to update guidelines every year, but when things are new and important and matter, the guidelines get updated.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling in. Dr. Doug Sawyer, Chief of Cardiovascular Services at Maine Medical Center and spokesman for the American Heart Association. Craig Brett, I want to back up a little bit. Can you give us a basic primer on how blood pressure works? What is being measured?
Yes. Thank you, Jennifer. So blood pressure is a very basic vital sign that has been for a long time known to be associated with problems involving the heart, the brain, the kidney. And when we measure blood pressure, we come up with two numbers, the top and the bottom number, otherwise known as the systolic and the diastolic. And the top number is the pressure that's in the blood vessels when the heart is actively contracting. And the bottom number, the diastolic number, is the pressure in the vessels when the heart is relaxing and refilling. Both numbers are important. The top number might be a little bit more important as people age.
What is happening inside the body when the blood pressure is too high, and why is that harmful?
So our blood vessels were meant to take a certain amount of pressure, and when that pressure is elevated chronically, it causes some injury to the lining of the blood vessels. It can often be a slow process over years or decades, but eventually that injury can result in formation of plaque and scar in the vessels and sometimes clotting.
Dr. Ammon, when you see patients with high blood pressure, what are the first steps you take?
So for all patients we see regularly, we check their blood pressures, check their pulse, check their weight at every visit, whether they're coming in for a cold or a sprained ankle or a physical. Oftentimes, the initial blood pressure we check will be high. So we kind of had made a program to check the blood pressure at the end of the visit as well, because we found that about 50% of the people come back to normal ranges after the visit, after they've been sitting for a while. There's lots of things that can affect the blood pressure, you know, traffic, having some coffee, having a cigarette right before you check the blood pressure. So one of the things that we do is make sure someone's rested in an ideal situation, you know, or we recheck it if it's high. So, you know, sometimes we'll see people specifically for blood pressure checks. Most of the time when we see people and they check their blood pressures in the context of something else. So we'll either address their blood pressure at that visit or perhaps have them come back for a nurse visit in a couple of weeks if their blood pressure is high, or come back with the doctor or the advanced practice professional for blood pressure recheck specifically to monitor that issue.
I have noticed that no matter what you go to your doctor for, there's always a blood pressure check, even if it's because you think you might have broken your toe. Why is that?
So it's a vital sign. So, you know, as a vital sign, it's very important to see where people are. A lot of people I'll see in the office will say, hey, doc, I came into the ER after a car accident and I was 180 over 110. We recheck it and it's 120 over 80. So we check it, you know, but we have to take under the circumstances kind of what's going on with their medical problems at the time to see if this is a valid check. And then obviously before we brand someone as having high blood pressure or hypertension, we'll recheck it several more times to make sure that's consistent.
Jennifer, this drives people crazy because blood pressure just is changing all the time. That's what it does. That's what it's supposed to do. And so it can be really distressing for patients when they come up with high numbers in the doctor's office. And I think it gets to a basic tenet of blood pressure management is you really need to know what the average is. Isolated spot readings are just not that helpful because it does change so much. And as Peter says, you know, so many things can influence it. So the best way to know what someone's blood pressure is to have a lot of readings and to get an average, both at the doctor's office, at home, you know, wherever they can get a check. The more readings they have, the more precise we can be in managing them.
Sure, I'm pretty certain I have white coat syndrome. I'm pretty certain mine goes up when it's about to be taken. One, I don't like how it feels, that sleeve. Do you all recommend that people have some sort of, I'm not even going to try to say what it's called, at home to take your own blood pressure reading?
You mean a sphygmomanometer?
That's what I was not going to say.
So we call it blood pressure cuff. It's a lot easier. I think it varies. You know, the analogy would be people who have diabetes. Some people do well and need to check their blood sugars at home regularly or periodically. With blood pressure, it's nice. The blood pressure cuffs that are available from any pharmacy are anywhere from $30 to $100. Most are pretty straightforward. You just need to make sure it's fitting the arm the correct way. And then, as Dr. Brett said, you know, taking blood pressures over time gives us a better reading of where they are, you know, on average. And like you said, some people are very high in the office, but normal in everyday life. Other people check their blood pressures at a local, you know, supermarket like Hannaford. Those are probably okay, but obviously one of the guidelines is you're supposed to be sitting for 5 minutes before you check a blood pressure. So I suspect people don't sit, wait 5 minutes, and then press the button. So I think ideally people, you know, who need to or who want to monitor their blood pressures at home, it gives us more information to make educated decisions about what to do.
Okay, let's talk about these new guidelines. Dr. Brett, how do they or do they influence how you treat your patients?
You know, we've actually known for a long time that the risk to patients' blood vessels is on a spectrum with their blood pressure. So whereas there's a lot of great science in this guideline, you know, it's based on something like 900 studies and, you know, really is quite a piece of work. You know, the basic knowledge that that patient's risk is linearly related to their blood pressure, we've actually known for some time. So I think I'm not sure it'll change my practice as a cardiologist as much as maybe Dr. Ammon's practice, because a lot of our patients are already being treated for hypertension or are already on medications that lower blood pressure for other cardiac disorders. So to be honest, I don't think it'll change my practice as much as the primary care providers.
Well, what about you, Dr. Ammon? How is it going to change?
So the guidelines have been about 2 weeks now, so hasn't changed much. You know, so we're still monitoring people regularly as we've done. We haven't made any specific changes to increase medications necessarily at this time. According to the new guidelines, there's a certain subset of people that need medications, you know, above a top blood pressure, the systolic blood pressure about 130. And those are the people that are high risk for heart disease or strokes. There's a calculator that is readily available online, and we have it in our electronic medical record where we could figure out someone's 10-year heart attack risk. And if that 10-year heart attack and stroke risk is more than 10%, then those are the people in that kind of gray zone or in the stage one hypertension that we are more likely to start medicines or add medicines to get their blood pressure lower.
So is that calculator the same calculator that it was 1 month ago before these guidelines came out? The algorithm is the same?
Yeah, the calculator hasn't changed, and there's different versions of the calculator. Interestingly, the calculator that you can find at American Heart, or you know, if you Google kind of heart risk calculator, most of them, as far as I've seen, don't include two important things. And the two important things they don't include are fitness, so how much do you exercise, and family history. So those are not included in the calculators, but they do include everything else that we typically would make a medical decision with. And the SPRINT trial, which was that big trial that came out in 2015, you know, calculated people's risk for heart attack and stroke over the next 10 years. And the group of people that they had in the trial had a risk of about 20%. So pretty high risk people. So those were the ones that they kind of made the decisions and the conclusions from that trial about how we treat the rest of the population with high blood pressure.
Did these guidelines change how you're able to talk with your patients? Is this something most people have read about in the news and are aware of?
I think, you know, there has been a lot of press around the new guidelines. And so I was going to add that has been actually helpful because, you know, patients, I think, don't necessarily realize how their risk relates to their blood pressure. And so it just leads to more discussion and maybe a more, you know, a patient being more amenable to the idea of treating their hypertension with this being in the news. The actual calculator, I think patients like when I plug in their variables and, you know, out spits a number. Of course, you know, the calculator is based on, you know, something like 100,000 people that were in the trial that the calculator was developed from. So it's not it doesn't give you an individual risk. It gives you a risk of, you know, people that are like them. And so you do the calculator, the guidelines are not, they're not rules necessarily. They're guidelines and they help you make a decision. But as Dr. Ammon pointed out, there are several things in the calculator that, or several things not in the calculator that can be quite important when you're making these decisions.
The other thing I would like to add about the new guidelines is that it gets away from defining people as having pre-hypertension. You know, the concept of pre-hypertension or pre-diabetes, to me and probably to patients, suggests you're not quite that bad yet, right? So your blood pressure is high, but it's not that bad because you're pre-hypertensive. We know that people who have a blood pressure of 130 or higher have a double the risk of heart attacks and strokes compared to 120 or lower. So twice the risk in my brain doesn't consist of pre-hypertension. I mean, they have hypertension. It's a group of people that we probably should be doing a better job treating.
Let me ask you that. You said twice the risk. What is the risk? Somebody, are we talking about 10% of the population, 20%, 30% if you have a blood pressure 130 or higher?
I believe, if I can recall the exact numbers, the risk basically dropped from 6% to 4% for these events. So, you know, that sounds substantial. You know, in relative terms, in absolute terms, you know, it's not as dramatic as maybe the relative terms make it out to be. But over a population, over millions of people, that's a lot less heart attacks and strokes if you can get people to a 4% risk instead of a 6%.
How about the do you believe there could be some resistance to coming to see your doctor because of these new guidelines?
I don't think so. I think people, generally speaking, come to the doctor because something's wrong. You know, they're often, I often ask my patients, you know, how are you doing today? And they say, well, if I was good, I wouldn't be here. You know, so they're coming with some issue. And it's not specifically, hey, my blood pressure is high. It's usually something else. And by the way, their blood pressure is high. I don't think patients are going to be resistant to making changes. You know, the new guidelines reflect and kind of are proponents of more lifestyle management for people, which we've been trying to preach for years in primary care. So that's not a change. But trying to tell people that, hey, your blood pressure is high, but with changes in diet, changes in exercise, quitting smoking, drinking less, getting better sleep, all those things can improve your blood pressure and improve your long-term health.
Tell us, how dramatically can they improve your blood pressure? Changing your diet, exercising, getting enough sleep.
So significantly. So there have been studies that show that on average, blood pressure pills, and Dr. Brett can correct me, will lower blood pressure of the top number between 7 and 10 points. And depending on which lifestyle intervention, those lifestyle interventions can decrease the top number for blood pressure 5 points or so each. So people can have significant changes in their blood pressure by drinking less, by losing weight, you know, by being more active. And, you know, it's a piece of the total puzzle of treating high blood pressure.
There's a basic tenet about weight loss in people who are overweight, that for every kilogram of weight that someone loses, their systolic blood pressure will go down by 1 to 2 millimeters of mercury. So, you know, if you can lose 10 or 20 pounds of weight, that's a major drop and better than a lot of our blood pressure pills.
I've read every pound is a mile of capillaries. Is that right?
I've not heard that one myself, but that sounds probably correct.
Oh, my goodness. Well, what do you think are some of the most common misconceptions about blood pressure?
I think, you know, blood pressure certainly is a life, it can be worsened by lifestyle issues, as we've been talking about. Obesity, smoking, alcohol excess, sedentary lifestyle, all those things can make blood pressure worse. But particularly in my practice at Mercy, we see a lot of people with hypertension and cardiology, and there is a subgroup of people that are just genetically predisposed to having high blood pressure, and it drives them nuts. They come in, they're thin, they're you know, healthy diet, they exercise all the time, and they're hypertensive, and they, you know, they're hard on themselves because they think it's, you know, something they're doing, and if only I ran, you know, that many more miles a week, my blood pressure would come down. But there's definitely a genetic predisposition to developing hypertension. You can make it worse with some of these lifestyle issues, but sometimes it happens without anything. And those people, unfortunately, just have to rely on pharmacology to get their blood pressure down.
And the other thing I want to mention is that, you know, hypertension is considered the silent killer in that most people have no symptoms. You know, and it's high blood pressure over 20, 30, 40 years that is causing damage to artery walls and plaque buildup, et cetera, which makes people a higher risk for heart attacks and strokes. You know, people can be symptomatic when their blood pressure is very high, you know, 200 over 120, they can get headaches or dizziness or other, you know, chest pains, things like that. But most of the time, people have zero symptoms for high blood pressure, which is a downside, right? So if you have a cold, you have symptoms, people want to treat that. You, with blood pressure, most of the time, you don't have symptoms. So people need to be educated on why it's important to treat their high blood pressure, you know, first with lifestyle changes and then obviously with medicines if need be, because of this silent killer is kind of slowly causing trouble over 20, 30, 40 years.
Well, if you'd like to join the conversation about the new blood pressure guidelines, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send us an email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
As the flow of new migrants has slowed, harvesting the nation's crops has been left to an aging population of farm workers. And their health has suffered from decades of hard labor.
The slowdown is happening. You could just see your production drop, but it's difficult to really manage because there's not the younger people aren't wanting to come in and work in this industry.
I'm Kelly McEvers. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered gets underway this afternoon at 4 o'clock.
There's no recipe for a successful relationship, but it's safe to say that honesty is an essential ingredient, right?
People believe what they want to believe. You cannot dissuade them. And it helped them. I mean, it made them happy, so big deal.
Falling in Love with a Lie on the next Hidden Brain from NPR.
And Hidden Brain can be heard Sunday morning at 11 a.m.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, blood pressure guidelines and what they mean for your health. With me in the studio, Peter Ammon. He's a family medicine physician and site leader for Maine Medical Partners. And Craig Brett, cardiologist with Mercy Hospital. We invite you to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us on the line now is Dr. Gilbert Welch. He's a professor of medicine at the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practices. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Welch. We saw your column in the New York Times, the headline, "Don't Let New Blood Pressure Guidelines Raise Yours." What are your concerns about the new guidelines?
Well, let me be clear that using medications to lower really high blood pressure is probably the most important preventive interventions that we doctors do. But I do worry about the downward drift about what's considered high blood pressure, and it's part of sort of a relentless expansion of medical care into the lives of millions of people. It's really important to lower high blood pressure, but it's less important as blood pressures get lower. And the study that led to new guidelines, for example, needed to treat about 50 patients for one to be helped. And so that means 49 people were treated who did not benefit. So it's just as we get into these boundary issues where it becomes a whole lot closer call that it really becomes worrisome. And the real problem I have with this particular decision is it's based on a study that I'm not sure really applies in the real world. And let me just comment on exactly how they measured blood pressure in this study. They put people in a quiet room by themselves for 5 minutes and then had them measure their own blood pressure. Now, that is a great way to measure blood pressure, but it's not really what happens in practice. And I worry that these guidelines will push doctors, and I really fear that it'll become a performance measure, that where doctors are credited for lowering blood pressure no matter what happens and whether it really helps the patient or not.
I know that this concern you have is part of a broader philosophy of yours about medical intervention generally.
Yeah, well, we've gotten, the problem of medical excess in the United States, I think, is pretty familiar to a lot of people, and we seem to be always expanding services and not asking the questions of whether they're really helping people or, in fact, whether they may hurt people. And so I do think we need to be very careful in expanding things that involve literally millions of people and may distract them. The focus on numbers and drugs may distract from really bigger issues where I'm sure all the doctors in your group will agree that, that this is really a question of how people eat and how well they move and finding meaning in life. Those are all really important things to people's health. But we're very focused on finding abnormalities and intervening on people.
Dr. Welch, I appreciate your balanced view on this. And I think, it does get to the concept of shared decision making. The absolute risk reduction is small over a population. It's a lot of people. But for that one patient in front of you, it is a small reduction in risk to get put on medications. And I think, it doesn't happen all the time, although it should, where you have a discussion with the patient about, we can make your risk go from this to this if you take this pill every day. And some patients will grab at that and lots won't. So I think I think your point is very well taken.
And if I can just add, I think the data here may not, the data that these guidelines were based on may not really apply to the real world. That's important, that this is a very idealized setting where blood pressure is measured in a sort of idealized way and then managed in an incredibly careful way, and that may not happen in the real world. In fact, it almost certainly won't.
Dr. Welch, what kind of reaction have you had to the editorial of 2 weeks ago?
I think in general, very positive. I think a lot of physicians worry about the constant expansion of medical care into more people's lives, and they're fearful that they're going to be measured on these things that leads them to do things that they might not do otherwise because they're not sure it's really in the best interest of their patients. We have a huge problem of over-medication in this country. We have people on too many medications. And again, I want to be clear. It's very important that everyone understand that using medications to lower really high blood pressure is very important. The question is how far you expand that.
Well, thanks so much for calling in, Dr. H. Gilbert Welch, Professor of Medicine with the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practices. We're going to move to our phones now. We're going to go to Tom calling from Parsonsfield. Hi, Tom. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi. Thank you. Just two questions. First question is regarding the genetic disposition for high blood pressure. One of your guests suggested is a real possibility. How do you know that if you've been thin and active and still come up with high blood pressure? At what point do you realize it is genetic? And then the other question I have is if you have had blood pressure for 20 or 30, 40 years, and one of your other guests suggested that there's some damage done to your kidneys, to your vessels and whatnot, is that then reversible if you lower your blood pressure?
Those are great questions. I'll start with the second part. The answer is yes. You can clearly see improvement in the lining of blood vessels and how blood vessels function after someone has treated this risk factor, as other risk factors as well. In terms of the genetic components of this, there's no practical specific genetic test that can be ordered for hypertension like there is for other diseases. It really comes down to just the history. These people that seem to have a very genetically determined a case of high blood pressure, so many people in their family have it. It's very, very reliable that you'll get a history like that in these people.
Thanks for your question, Tom. I'm going to move now to an email from Bob. This has been summarized. He writes, I've had borderline high blood pressure and have resisted medications. Average blood pressure 142 over 76. I'm on no medications up until my recent PC doctor visit when he started me on lisinopril. Got home, looked at side effects, including blurred vision, confusion, dizziness, and more. No, thank you. I'm not taking this med. I'm sharp and asymptomatic now, and you want me to risk these side effects? No. These new guidelines seem like a good way for drug companies to sell drugs to people who don't need them. This is an issue of trust. We need objective research without drug company bias.
So I'll take that one. So I think, you know, any medication, if you look at the entire list of potential side effects, would be daunting. You know, anything over the counter that you look at the list of potential side effects, we wouldn't take any. The reality is most people do very well on these medicines. Most of these medicines are very well tolerated. People have few side effects. A lot of them are generic, so they're not very expensive. Most of them are once a day, so they're not very inconvenient to take. And we know, as we mentioned earlier, there's great data to suggest that lowering your blood pressure over long periods of time will decrease your risk for heart attacks, strokes, kidney problems, et cetera. So it's always a balance between the potential side effects and risks of a medicine versus the potential benefits from taking that medicine to lower your blood pressure over time.
And would you say to Bob, who says, I'm sharp and asymptomatic now, that that really is not an indicator of anything?
Right. So, you know, as we mentioned already, this is the silent killer. So people can have no symptoms for 20 years, and then over time, you know, the analogy I sometimes use with my patients is plumbing, right? So over time, the high blood pressure in your pipes at home can cause disruption. You're going to get a leak. You're going to get problems with your pipes down the line. Whereas day by day, you're not going to see any difference in your water pressure at home.
And I would ask Bob if he was here. I'd say, Bob, how much do you weigh? How much are you drinking? How active are you? I would have a few more questions for you because I bet there's a lot of things that you might be able to do to not take that lisinopril.
We have a tweet from Terry. Would you mind repeating the new guidelines? Google doesn't cut it.
So the major change in the new guidelines is that treatment is recommended for people at risk when their blood pressure is over 130 for the top number or 80 to 90 on the bottom number. That's the change from the previous guideline where it was 140 on the top and 90 on the bottom. That's really the principal change.
All right. We've got Peter
calling from the Portland area. If I can click on it, there you go. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Oh, good afternoon. I had an occasion once to find out what my blood pressure was. I was in Maine Medical. My roommate had a perfusion pump, and it ran dry. He couldn't reach his button to call the nurse. It set off an alarm. So I pressed my button. My nurse came too and took my blood pressure. And she said, oh, is it always this high? I said, what is it? 220 over 110. And I laughed and said, only when I'm floating on the ceiling. Then I explained that the tone of the perfusion pump running dry was the same as my fire department tone on my pager. And now I knew what my blood pressure was when I had a call. Now, the question is, does an occasional or semi-frequent rise in blood pressure of this type affect you over the period of time, or is it just sort of incidental?
So it's a great question, and you know, your blood pressure did exactly what it was supposed to do. You had a stress response. Your body secreted hormones and adrenaline-like substances that resulted in your blood pressure going up. That's an adaptive response. So your body did exactly what it was supposed to do. People that have hypertension, the difference is that they stay at these elevated numbers even when that type of situation is not there. And so it gets to another issue about stress and hypertension. And people who are acutely stressed, like you were at that moment, will have a spike. And that's okay as long as the average is running well. People who are chronically stressed can have chronically elevated blood pressures. And those people, I think, are a particularly tough group to treat. I get people referred over at Mercy. You know, they're on four or five blood pressure meds and their blood pressure is still running very high. And you get a detailed history and you're like, oh, my God, this person has a lot going on. They are stressed out of their mind. And you realize you're probably not going to get that blood pressure under control until you treat the underlying stressful situation, if you can.
Peter, thanks for your question. Good question. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566. Our email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. An email from Gary. He writes, I lowered my blood pressure from 140 over 90 to 105 over 70 by switching to a whole foods plant-based diet. No meds.
So that's the way we'd like it done. So in a perfect world, people would eat better, you know, move more, kind of drink more water, you know, and fewer glasses of alcohol, you know, less soda, you know, kind of get adequate sleep, quit smoking. You know, most of high blood pressure, most of diabetes, most of heart disease would improve if people were able to make those, you know, all of them in and of themselves are small, but altogether are huge changes to someone's lifestyle.
We'll go to Josephine calling from Biddeford. Hi, Josephine. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes. I have I'm an athlete. I'm a runner. I'm going to do the Millinocket half very shortly. And my heart rate's great. And in the past few months, I just found out that I have high blood pressure. And my life's a tiny bit stressful right now. And my mother had high blood pressure. But all the other risk factors don't apply to me. And I'm not a person who wants to take medication. Is there alternative things that people recommend? I don't have any risk factors other than my mother having high blood pressure.
So unfortunately, I think you may have inherited some genetics that that caused this. It sounds like there's not a lot of lifestyle issues to correct there. And you may be in that group we talked about earlier that you know, we don't have a lot to offer to get your blood pressure down except pills. If you're already doing things right, there's certainly some, you know, some natural substances that some folks will, you know, will encourage. There's not a lot of science on several of these. You know, you could try some of those things, but I think you may end up needing a pill, unfortunately. And it's a very frustrating situation when somebody is a slave to their genetics with that type of problem.
Josephine, good luck to you, and good luck this, you said this weekend is the half marathon?
9th, actually.
Okay, well, have a great race, and thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Before we take a quick break, a word about Monday's program. We will talk about the tax overhaul bill and what it could mean for Mainers and the rest of the country. Email your comments or questions to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet us, or post on our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. Stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do University of New England. Ranked in the Princeton Review, U.S. News and World Report, Forbes, and more, une.edu. And Finance Authority of Maine, working for Maine by helping businesses grow jobs and families reach their higher education goals, famemaine.com.
If you spend 30 years in jail for a crime you didn't commit, how much money should you get paid by the state? Victor Rosario has an idea.
It's no money in this whole entire world that they can pay even for one day to be a wrongful conviction.
On next from the New England News Collaborative, Wrongful Convictions and Rightful Restitution. I hope you can join us.
And join us for next, coming up after Maine Calling at 2.
Next time on Living on Earth, the Republican chair of the Congressional Climate Solutions Caucus is not waiting for President Trump to act.
I've said over and over again that this administration is leaving a vacuum of leadership in the area of climate change. Let's try to fill that void through congressional action.
I'm Steve Kerwood, and we meet Florida Congressman Carlos Curbelo next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
Join us for Living on Earth Sunday morning at 7.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, how much does blood pressure matter? And what about those new guidelines? Joining me today, Craig Brett, head of Mercy Cardiology, and Peter Ammon with Scarborough Family Medicine. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. John sends an email. I would like to know the doctor's opinion of people that exhibit healthy blood pressure and have no normal diagnosis of heart disease, yet they still experience a heart attack. Does this relate to arterial plaque? And is there a test for plaque?
So developing blockages in the arteries that feed the heart is what causes a heart attack. And that process, there are several things involved. It's not just hypertension or high blood pressure. It's genetics. It's your blood pressure. It's your blood sugar. It's your blood cholesterol levels. It's what kind of things you've been doing to your body, like cigarette smoke, et cetera. So it's really a multifactorial process. However, hypertension is one of the major risks in that whole process developing.
Caroline on Facebook asks, the easiest way to amass money is to treat people for things that are not problems. You will have an admirable rate of good outcomes while killing only a subset that suffers bad reactions to the meds inevitably prescribed, wisely or not. This is relating to what we talked about with Dr. Welch earlier in the program.
Yes, I'm smiling. Thank you. That's a great comment. I think, you know, first of all, I don't think these medications are all generic now. They've all been out for a long time. So I think, you know, there's some natural suspicion that all this is, you know, drug company funded and sponsored. And that's really not an issue with hypertension. Fortunately, these meds have been around and are all generic. So I think, you know, hopefully that relieves some of the suspicion. Look, I hate putting people on blood pressure pills. That does not make my day in any way. And I would much rather people get it down with the things we've been talking about. But you know, the science is the science, and you know, there's no argument against the fact that lowered blood pressure does help your odds of not having a heart attack, stroke, or kidney failure.
So let's talk about some guidelines. We hear the same thing over and over again. Plant-based diet, exercise, cut down how much you drink, don't smoke. So are we supposed to all go vegan and run half marathons?
So I think there's a variability in the extent to which people can kind of follow a kind of healthy lifestyle. It's not an all or none. You know, there's a continuity of kind of what is good. So, for example, you know, people who do zero exercise, they don't get up at all, doing a little bit. You know, there was a good study that showed that women in a nurse's health study in Boston who did zero exercise and went to 1 hour a week. So 1 hour a week. So you're talking about 10, 15 minutes a day, cut down their risk of heart attacks by about 40 to 50%. So that's a huge decrease in their risk for bad things happening by a small increment in what they're doing. So ideally, we're getting people to move around 150 minutes a week, and that certainly could be divided into 5 times 30 or, you know, 10 minutes several times a day. And that exercise should be moderate, right?
So, it's not, when you say move, go on a walk?
So a vigorous walk. So a walk where you can, you know, talk with someone but not have an easy conversation. So if you can whistle, you're not walking hard enough. But, you know, any kind of activity, A, that you enjoy, B, that you can do with somebody, C, that you can schedule, is going to be the activity that you're going to follow through with and do over time. So the goal, like I said, is to get people to around or over 150 minutes a week of regular exercise.
What are you recommending for diet?
So if people choose to go vegan, great. That will decrease their cholesterol. It will improve their blood sugars. It will improve their blood pressure, but not always. People can be vegetarian 2 days a week. People can be vegetarian 1 day a week or one meal a day. People can increase the amount of fruits or vegetables they eat. What I try to talk to my patients about is try to measure something that you're doing differently. Try to measure if you're eating more fruits and vegetables. Keep track of how many more per day. If you're cutting back on soda, try to cut back one per day. I love fitness trackers because it keeps track of how active or conversely how inactive we are. And some of them will buzz to say, hey, you haven't moved in 60 minutes. Get up and move. There's a new quote that's come out saying sitting is the new smoking. That people who, even if they exercise, if they sit for 8 straight hours, have a higher risk of, you know, cardiovascular disease, stroke, than if they're able to get up during the course of the day. So the best thing to do is, after you've been sitting for a while at your desk or at your computer, get up and walk around. You know, go to talk to someone rather than sending that email. You know, take the long route to the lunchroom or to the bathroom. So you're increasing the amount of exercise you're doing during the course of your day. And if you can do a 10-minute walk, you know, with your lunch or after dinner, then that's awesome.
You mentioned sodas. How bad is sugar for your heart?
Well, it's sugar and kind of refined carbohydrates can affect your heart in many ways, mostly all indirectly. So they'll, you know, they can change a lipid profile so that someone's cholesterol and type of cholesterol pattern will be different. If they don't have good clearance systems, their blood sugar may run higher, and those things over time affect the heart. So. So it's an indirect effect. I just want to get back, though, Dr. Ammon, I think that the diet and the exercise changes. I think you do get the biggest bang for your buck. But there's some other things, too, that are not always there's as much awareness of. So people that use anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen, naproxen, you know, I know a lot of people that just take that stuff all the time. They're sore. They just down it. And those can really raise your blood pressure if you take it chronically. No problem with short-term use, but chronically, you know, taking it most days can really raise blood pressure. And I don't think a lot of people know that. The other thing is alcohol. You know, although kind of that alcohol may feel like your blood pressure is lower, beyond the kind of 1 to 2 drink mark, you really get a sharp increase in blood pressure. So that's something to remember as well.
Especially with alcohol, the goals are that men are drinking 2 or fewer servings per day, and women drink, you know, 1 or fewer servings per day, as well as elderly people. And I always tell my patients that, you know, 2 or fewer per day doesn't mean you can drink 14 on Friday, and that's it.
We'll go to Robert calling from Naples. Hi, Robert. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Good afternoon. I just wanted to call. I heard the conversation today, and it really kind of struck a chord with me. December 1st, 17 years ago, my father dropped dead suddenly from essentially what was untreated high blood pressure. He had kind of moderate high blood pressure that was always attributed to like white coat syndrome. And so he was really never put on any blood pressure medication. They really just kind of kept an eye on him. And he was 60 years old, out for a walk, and just dropped dead. And it was a ventricular hypertrophy that did him in, and they attributed it to really untreated high blood pressure that really just went under the radar for years and years and years.
It's a great entree into the discussion. You know, one of the things that high blood pressure does over time that is also not well appreciated, which may have been the case here, is it does make the heart muscle thicken. And the analogy is, you know, when a weightlifter is pumping iron all day, they get big arms. That might be good. When your heart is pushing against inordinately high blood pressures, it also thickens. That's not good, because a thick heart muscle is a stiff heart muscle, and it doesn't fill as easily as it should. And that reduces people's performance. They can feel short of breath. They can get into trouble with swelling and heart failure. I don't know why he had such thickness if his blood pressure wasn't that high. There are some other things that can do that, including some genetic causes. But hypertension is a major cause of this thickening of the heart, which later in life really causes trouble.
So thank you, Robert, for your call. People who are really at risk are people who don't go to the doctor regularly, aren't there?
Right. Right. So ideally, people are seeing, or A, they have a doctor or, you know, provider to see. B, they're checking their blood pressures at least once a year, probably, especially for the older folks. You know, and these are people that probably should have some regular labs or some, you know, tetanus booster or things like that, colonoscopy. So there are other preventive tests that not only with blood pressure, but other things that we should be checking people regularly. They don't have to come in every month necessarily, but once we, you know, it's important to see their provider regularly so we can do some screening tests, including blood pressure and cholesterol and, you know, metabolic panel to see which we should address and which we might make some lifestyle changes first or medication changes to help them feel better.
I'm always amazed at Mercy. We'll see people who come in and they may be professionals and every aspect of their life is squared away and they're on top of everything. And yet some of them don't know their most basic numbers. They don't know what their cholesterol is. They don't know what their blood sugar is elevated, if their blood pressure has been elevated. And it's always remarkable that they don't think of those things because, again, they don't feel it.
Robert writes an email, if one is already on medication to bring blood pressure down to 140, are there additional concerns or risks with additional medication to bring it down to 130?
So the lower you get your blood pressure, especially for older people, the risk could be that you're going too low. I always tell people 120 over 80 is normal, but 115 over 75 is healthier. But there's going to be some point that the blood pressure is too low, and when they stand up, their blood pressure will drop. They can get dizzy. They can increase risk for falls. In the SPRINT trial that they just published in 2015, they did have some increased risks of low blood pressure, obviously with the tighter control group. They had more risks of electrolyte problems. So the people in the control group versus the standard group had about 3 medicines that they were taking versus 2 medicines they were taking in control group. So there probably were a little bit higher risk of side effects from those.
Okay. We'll go to a Christine calling from Mount Vernon. Hi, Christine. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I have a question about my husband's blood pressure. It's always been around the 138 range. And he was told by a doctor a few years ago that because it's always been at that place, that he really doesn't need to worry, that he should be more concerned about changes or increases. And I just wanted to ask if that seems like decent advice.
Well, I think, you know, that's a good call, because that really gets to the heart of this new guideline. A month ago, I would have agreed with his doctor. Now, with at least having this guideline and the knowledge that the guideline arose from, I would say, well, that's high. That's stage 1 hypertension. And I would go through the lifestyle issues that might be able to treat that, but I would try to get him down under 130 and preferably 120.
Christine, thanks for your question. We'll head up to Gorham and Allie. Hi, Allie. Go ahead.
Hi there. My husband and I are listening, and we're curious about the role that, like, chronic pain may play in elevated blood pressure over time, you know, knee pain or back pain that someone's in for extended period of time.
Yeah, I think chronic pain is a subset of chronic stress, and it really causes the same type of response in the body with a release of stress hormones and adrenaline-like substances. All those things increase blood pressure. The body was meant to do that for short term. That's adaptive. But when it's chronic, then you have high blood pressure that can be hard to treat.
Good luck to you, Allie, and thank you for your call. And you're going to be our last call today. We have to say thank you and goodbye. Dr. Peter Ammon, site leader for Maine Medical Partners with Scarborough Family Medicine. Dr. Craig Brett, a cardiologist, medical director for Mercy Hospitals, Mercy Cardiology. John Keimel ran the board today. Owen Manahan took your calls. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. It's Monday on the program, Understanding the Tax Bill. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.